Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of TetraCast, RPG Site's weekly podcast. I'm your host. My name is Brian Vitale. Joining me, I have Josh Torres.
It's perfect bird time.
Adam Vitale.
Hello.
And Chowman Wu.
How's it going?
Yeah, no Mikhail. He's asleep, I presume. And James has a family obligation. So it'll be the four of us today. Also, thank you for covering for me last week because I wasn't here. I know you guys talked a bit about, I believe, Beast of Reincarnation and a few other games like Village in the Shade. So that was pretty cool. This week, we're going to take a different approach. There's no really new release to talk about. Well, there is one, but we'll touch on it. But we're going to start this one on a upcoming game for next month, and that is Fire Emblem Fortune's Weave. We don't do this often, but Fire Emblem is a big enough game, and we've had a big enough preview opportunity that Adam and then also Cullen, who contributes to the site as well, were able to go hands-on with the game, and they put up a feature for that, and I'll let Adam speak to it more. And you know, Fire Emblem is a big game for our site. We have a lot of people that are really excited about Fortune's Weave, especially kind of coming off the tale of Engage, which is a little bit received a little bit more lukewarmly. So I'm curious to hear about this. And then that way we can just kind of allow Adam to, you know, talk about his written piece that he put together with Cullen. And then just kind of speak to it more in depth here in podcast format. I kind of earmarked out a little bit of time here because even though you guys talked about it last week, I did play Beast of Reincarnation over the last 2 weeks, and I have a few impressions that I at least just want to dovetail in, just kind of squeeze those in. And then we will talk about a little bit about the upcoming Steins Gate reboot. It comes out later in the month, but James was able to put up his review. We'll at least point to the review and kind of give a high-level impression of it, but obviously once James is back on the podcast, we'll give him an opportunity to speak more at length. But, you know, so if you're wondering where our podcast review of Steins Gate is, that'll be in a later week. But we'll at least kind of give you the overview here this week. And then a few other headlines, news, the usual trailers. Upcoming busy September, as we all know. So we'll touch on that when we get there. But without further ado, we're going to start out with Adam talking in a preview context for the upcoming Fire Emblem Fortune's Weave, which comes out in basically a month plus or minus a few days. So take it away, Adam.
I guess the first thing I'll say is there's a lot that I cannot talk about, and I'm not going to try to like slink around it and be super vague and be like, you know, teasing or whatever. I'm going to stick to the, you know, the limits of the preview embargo, which what those are the opening prologue to the game and then the early section of the heroic games for each of the main four characters. So if you saw the direct last week, then you saw what the premise of the game kind of actually is, which was not revealed when the game was announced. And just to be very brief and kind of setting up the premise of the game, your main character that you create at the beginning of the game, Eshmel, are basically wake up, gain consciousness 5 years after the events of the heroic games, give or take. And you are basically tasked by the goddess Fortuna, who is a new character, to the demon god Balor has taken over the world. I'll be honest, at this point, I don't know a whole lot about Balor yet. I haven't got that far in the game, but he's the main villain. The world is in ruins. This continent is destroyed, hellish, and basically Fortuna's plan to fight him is we need warriors. So I am the goddess of causality, and what I'm going to do is we're going to go back in time to the heroic games, and we are going to change the causality of different participants in those games that took place several years ago. And so you do a few prologue battles as you're getting used to the, you know, as it tutorializes the game and whatnot. And then you basically get to a point, it's called the Obelisk Room, which is sort of like the hub room in the game. And you get from here, you get to choose which of the four characters you want to play as in the heroic games. So there is this sort of time travel, timey-wimey aspect to it. And at that point, you get to choose either the four characters. And as you have probably read by now, if you're listening to this, this isn't like Three Houses where you pick a route and that is your route and you're stuck with it for the rest of the game. You can actually like pick a route, play it, and then at any time jump between routes. Now, one thing I want to be clear about also is that like these four routes that you play, they are not all like in the same like canonical timeline. They are basically like four different versions of events. It's kind of, think of it like a multiverse. So if you recruit, you can recruit the same character on multiple routes, right? That's kind of what it gets to, is you're not like, oh, I recruited this character on Leda's route, so that means he's no longer available on Theodora's route. No, it's, they're kind of separate, but you can jump between them. The idea is that you're kind of messing around with time to bolster your forces. And that's the premise of the game. So it's not, none of that's a spoiler. You learn this very early on. And it is, when I played this, I got the code before the direct, and it was unexpected. Like, I didn't have any idea what was going on at the beginning, because I was expecting all this heroic game stuff right away, but that's not what the case. Now, in terms of, like, the story and the characters and the kind of the overall, like, structure of the game, I think the one way in this is way different than Three Houses. In Three Houses, all the characters that you play as in the different houses of this school are more or less there for the same reason. And the starting of those routes are all the same, more or less. I mean, I know there's some different like class battles or whatnot, but, and then it's only partway through the game where things start to split. The way in which Fortune's Weave is different is that everyone is coming to Dagzian, which is the capital of Dagda, the capital where the heroic games are taking place, for a different reason. They're all taking place in the heroic games, but they all have a different purpose for doing so. For example, Kai wants to save his father, who is in jail. Leda is trying to find her father's murderer, who is said to be around at the games. Theodora is the queen of a fledgling kingdom who looking to curry favor with the divine sovereign of the nation, who is at the heroic games. And Dietrich is there for the hell of it. He just wants to fight people.
Hell yeah.
Yeah. There's a little bit more to it than that, but that's kind of the original starting reason why he's there. He actually just washes ashore, and he's just like, oh, might as well while I'm here. So
I was saying, like, in the direct, they kind of show his, like, story premise. He was, like, lost at sea, and there's, like, sounds like a giant whale or something.
Yeah.
And then it's like, oh, I've got to participate in these games. This sounds like fun.
This is simplifying it a bit, but it's literally like I was shipwrecked by a giant sea monster. I need a boat. Where can I get a boat? I'm gonna go to the games. They have a boat there, so I need a boat to go out and fight the sea monster again.
Big bam of that story. I mean,
sometimes you just need a straight shooter that doesn't have a complicated premise.
Now it's very evident early on there are more characters at the heroic games that are very important. In fact. When you, I'm trying to be careful. I don't think this is outside of embargo restrictions. When you, in the prologue section of the game, when you're basically learning about the heroic games from like the past, because your character doesn't know anything about them, there are statues that you see of eight characters at the games, not four characters, eight characters. You have Leda, Theodora, Dietrich, and Kai, but then there's four other characters: Orchel, Talimon, Bertrand, and Anatolia. If you've been looking at the preview coverage early, marketing of the game, you might know who these characters are. Anatolia is the monk with a gun. Orchel has the cat mask. Bertrand is the white maned demon, kind of like barbarian axe guy. And Talimon is kind of like a smooth talking merchant guy who has connections everywhere. So my point is that when you're coming to Dagzian and you're taking place in these events here. First of all, yeah, I'm trying to be careful that I don't go beyond the preview limit. But there's all these characters here that you meet, and not every character gets the same amount of screen time in every route. And if you're Cullen and I kind of had the same feeling, because he started with Kai and I started with Leda, and they kind of just throw you in the deep end in terms of like who is who and what is what. And I actually kind of appreciate that this game is not super expository. Of course, there's some exposition, but you kind of just have to learn, like, who are all these characters? There's a lot of people here, and they all have different reasons for being here. And there's, as you might expect, there's more to these heroic games than just, a competition. There's more to it than that. And if you just play, like, one character, gotta be careful what I say here, it just kind of makes sense that you're not going to see the full picture of what's all going on here, and how does everyone fit in? How do all the pieces fit together? So there's going to be a little bit of that like with Three Houses, where, yeah, you only need to play one route. In fact, I think you technically don't need to play any routes, but if you want to get like the full picture of like what is all going on during the game, during the games, then you kind of have to see all the routes. So, which I guess is in one way nice, because you don't want all the routes to be exactly the same where you see the exact same things four times over, right? But it's complicated. You're kind of seeing bits and pieces of all these things going on. So that's kind of the route structure to this game. Did you have a thought, Brian?
Yeah, so I'll be honest. I have not read the most, or I have not watched the most recent Nintendo Direct, because I was already kind of watching you play it a little bit. And I've seen some of the reaction to it, though, like with more characters with guns and another character that can do Kamehameha or whatever like that. So a lot of my questions are just kind of like more general in terms of like, and I'm trying to keep it, you know, just very vague premise stuff, is this game obviously has explicit connections to Three Houses. Can you, you just said it takes place in Dagda, which is a place that you never, if I recall, visit in Three Houses, but as you meet characters from there, and, you know, it's a part of the world that you learn about in that game. Can you go a little bit more into how it's connected, or is it pretty loose, or do you not know yet?
There are definitely connections. I don't fully know how it's connected right now. And when you have that causality stuff, it kind of gets weird. But
yeah,
like, for example, and this is not a spoiler or minor, I don't think this is a spoiler. Dietrich is from Fodlan, and he's traveling on a boat. Okay. And they actually mention that, like, his sword that he wields and the house that he's from is one of, like, the 10 great houses of Fodlan, which, if you remember Three Houses, you know, is one of those. And there are basically people mention Fodland here and there, and Fabio, for instance, who kind of works with Dietrich, he says he's from the Church of Saros. And so, like, the Church of Saros doesn't exist in Dagda, but it, you know, if you played Three Houses, you know what that is. It's the church at Fodland. And they have different gods. Like, the Dagdan gods are different than the Fodland gods. In Dagzian, the gods, it's almost like ancient Rome, where the gods, like, literally just hang out and you can speak to them and talk to them and they're right there. They're not like Sothis, who is just, you know, mostly unseen or whatever. To answer your question, Fodlan exists and is mentioned and is referenced. And if you remember in Three Houses, there was like Brigid, which is where that purple haired girl was from. I forget her name in Three Houses. Who spoke with slightly different English in the dub.
I know exactly who you're talking about, but I'm also...
I don't remember her name. But basically, like, there's Fodland, and then you head southwest to Brigid, which is, like, an archipelago, and then southwest from there is where Dagda is. And, for example, there's actually another character you meet in the game who is from Brigid, who has the same color hair. So it just kind of feels like, oh, this is a new part of the world with different religion, different people, different, you know,
Petra.
Different gods. Tetra, yeah. So, like, there's references to Brigid in this game, so it just kind of feels like a different part of the world. Now, in terms of, like, timeline stuff, it's a little confusing because of the causality stuff, and I probably shouldn't get to it anyway. And I guess the calendars are different, so people have looked into that, but it's not a major part of the game. It's just kind of, like, referenced and, you know, acknowledged that Fodland exists. But it's kind of
new world. So pretty loose, Not like this is direct continuation. Have to do that one first.
No, you don't have to play Three Houses to understand this,
which I think was pretty evident. But it's good to hear it again from the preview context.
Go for it, Josh.
Two questions. Yeah. So first off, like, you know, since this is going to be, you know, many people new to Fire Emblem, their first one was Three Houses, and of course for people who already played, you know, a bunch of Fire Emblem before Three Houses, I think one of the agreed upon weaknesses was the structure of having to constantly visit the monastery frequently after, like, every battle, every event. It just became like a very monotonous loop, because they would always find, like, some justification that we always have to visit the monastery again. While in the direct for Fortune's Weave, it seems like in your free time you do have more flexibility to go beyond what looks like to be like the home hub. Can you dive into, like, how does the game handle that? It looks like a little bit like maybe it was a little bit of Shadows Valentia-esque,
yeah,
you know.
Now, again, I'm somewhat limited on the preview context, because basically I'm allowed to talk about the first five chapters, I believe, of each character's route. And like the first four chapters of each route, I believe, are not, there is no free time. They're more like classic Fire Emblem, battle after battle after battle. It's basically the first three or four chapters for each route is kind of, how did this character get to Daxian? So there's no free time in a lot of the sections that I can talk about. And it's they're more simple battles, you know, kind of easing you in to the routes. Like, for example, in Dietrich's route, he winds up at a fishing village where he meets Esmeralda, the green-haired girl. And she actually has the crest of Dimitri or whatever that house is called. And her ancestors were from Fodlan, and she didn't even know that. Not a spoiler. That's revealed relatively early on. When you get to about chapter 5 or so, that's when you get to Daxian, and that's when like the free time opens up. And so during free time, this is where the game kind of feels a little bit more like Three Houses in a structure, in that what'll happen is it'll be like, hey, your next match in the Heroic Games is on June 20th or whatever. It is currently May, 25th or whatever. So you have roughly a month to do whatever you want before the next main match. So that's similar to Three Houses, where you had like the calendar and you would see on the calendar, today is whatever day and this is the day of the next mission or whatever. In this game, there's actually a couple of smart things that it does, in that it actually gives you a preview of the match. This is through the causality framing, where the bird, I'll talk about the bird later, that pale raven gives you a preview of the match and basically says, like, it kind of gives you hints like, here's what level you should be. Here's the type of weapons that you should have, like bronze or iron. And there's a lot of armored characters, so you better make sure you have magic or armored slaying weapons. So it kind of gives you a hint to like, hey, you have a month. In that month, you probably should make sure your mages are up to snuff and you get a hammer axe or a Flissa sword or whatever, because you're going to be fighting armored enemies. I think that's kind of smart, in that none of the main matches should catch you off guard in terms of like, well, how was I supposed to know that, you know, these are the type of enemies that I was going to be fighting?
You built your team quote wrong.
It gives you a preview to basically kind of hint, like, you should have some of these. And it's not like a big ask for you to be like, oh, I need to make sure my axe user has a hammer axe. Like, that's pretty easily done. That's not like a big ask. Anyways, so unlike Three Houses, where you're basically going around the monastery each and every day, and you're kind of doing the same routine events each and every day. Yeah. Now you have the city of Daxian, which you will be going through the city of Daxian a lot, like a lot, like the monastery, but you also have the whole world around it too. And this is where the game has a tinge. I've said this when we talked about the direct, of like Metaphor Refantasio feeling, because now you have like, you know, you have a deadline and then you have so much time that each action on the map takes. And you only get so much time before basically the game just kind of forces you into the next battle. So you kind of have to decide which way do you want to explore? You know, do you want to do battles? Do you want to search for materials? Do you want to do those dungeons? And you can't do everything. And also, one thing that's worth mentioning is that this game only has one save file. And it has an autosave also, but the autosave saves over that one save file. It's not like separated, like manual autosave. And the game doesn't autosave all the time, but it autosaves frequently. Like, for example, after every battle, or if you enter a dungeon or a town. So what that means is if you're exploring the map and you run into a battle, you do a battle that you choose to do, it's going to save right there. And like that decision is locked in. You cannot, you know, what I guess my point is, you can't like save scum and be like, let me go in this direction and see what happens over here. And nope, I decided I don't like that. Let me reload an older save and go the other direction. Like, you're kind of more locked into your choices that way. Mm-hmm.
Is that now, why I'm too scared to open the door?
Well, yes. Yeah. Now there is, you can still cheese it a little bit. As long as you don't get into a battle, you're fine. So like, there have been times where I'm exploring the map and I kind of like head north. I'm like, let's see what's up here. And then as long as I avoid battles and be like, nah, I don't like this, let me reload my save because it hasn't auto-saved over it yet. You can do that. And also, as kind of one final kind of fallback, during any chapter, The game is divided into chapters. During any chapter, you can restart the chapter. So,
okay.
So like, let's just say you're playing on hard mode or something. You made really bad decisions, and your team is just like not well prepared for the battle, and you were just stuck. You can always just, you're going to lose some progress, of course, but it's better than being stuck. You can always just restart the chapter entirely and like, all right, redo that last month, try again, you know, make better decisions this time or whatever. I've never had to do that. I'm playing on normal mode. Make sure I get through it in time, but, might be useful if you're playing on harder difficulties and you're really needing to fine tune your strategies and your builds and whatnot. On the world map, there are basically search points that you go to that you can find food. And there's also cities that you can go to buy weapons, to buy items, to buy gifts. And different cities have different types of weapons. Like, for example, there might be a city that specializes in axes. So if you have an axe character and you want to make sure they get a better axe, you might need to make a trip there and get a better axe, because that can make a big difference if you're doing, you know, 5 more damage with every swing because you have a stronger axe now or whatever. So these are the sorts of things you're thinking about when you're traveling. And then you also have the dungeons. Now, yeah, the dungeons are definitely reminiscent of Shadows of Valentia in that, because that's the only other Fire Emblem game with dungeons where you're kind of traversing a map that's not just like a gridded, you know, tactical map. However, like Shadows of Valentia, the dungeons were full of like mini battles that were more just the traditional Fire Emblem battles. Now they have like a new system which are called clashes, which is a little bit interesting and weird. It's sort of like a turn-based RPG, but not quite. Basically, each of your characters has like an HP pool and a magic pool if they're a magic character, and you get to basically choose which character you want to attack which enemy. But you don't get to choose like all your characters in like a round. You kind of like each turn you pick a different character, and you can pick the same character over and over again if you want. I've gotten to the point where it's actually easier for me just to do the auto battle on the clashes, because it usually works out pretty well.
Okay.
You hold down the plus button on the Switch controller, and then it just auto battles, and it usually turns out okay. I don't think it's a very interesting battle system, but one thing I do appreciate about it is that it's fast. Shadows of Valentia kind of felt like you've got to do, you know, a handful of half dozen battles in a dungeon and, you know, slows things down. But here it's just like run into a clash, they're done in less than a minute. And especially oftentimes I'm just skipping through them and having them auto battle. It doesn't take too long at all. And in these dungeons, there are chests that you can pick up that sometimes have really good items, like special weapons and things like that. So they're worth getting for that. You get materials. Materials can be either used for food, which you can use to heal when you're on the world map, or can be used for smithing at the blacksmith. Like, for example, you can raise your weapons to a +1 or +2, and that can do a lot more damage if you do that. So it's worth it. And I actually found that dungeons are actually a pretty reliable way to gain EXP.
It's like a universal level, like whatever you actually gain experience from those, and you can bring it back to like the actual strategy.
Yeah. So I've actually found that it almost feels like it's faster to gain EXP through those than through the regular battles in a way.
Interesting.
So like one thing I do is like if my one thing that the game tracks is your average party level. And now that can sometimes be brought down if you have a lot of like bench warmers, but like let's just say my average party level is 25 and I see a dungeon that's like level 28, like a little bit above me, I'll do it. And you know, I might need to be careful or whatever, but like that's a good way to like, you know, kind of reach, step up your levels and relatively quickly. So more so than fighting skirmishes on the map where you kind of have to fight enemies one by one in the normal turn-based battles. But yeah.
But doing this does consume like free time though.
Yes.
It's not like something that's like a free action.
Yep. Okay. Basically each action on the map, it's a little bit confusing at first. When you look at the lower left corner of the map or of the UI, it says what the date, it says what time it is, and then it also says during free time, like how many turns are left until the deadline. And I was a little confused at first. I was like, wait, there's like a clock and turns? That's tricky. Like, I gotta manage both of these things. And then I realized this is a little bit more just clerical, but the clock itself doesn't really matter. each day is broken up into four turns. It goes from midnight to 6 a.m., 6 a.m. to noon, noon to 6 p.m., and 6 p.m. to midnight. And so those are your four turns per day. Sorry, this is kind of very specific, but it's one of those things that it's going to be immediately confusing to people when they start up this game. When you're exploring town, you look at the lower left corner of your screen, and it'll say, like, it's 2:30 in the afternoon or whatever. And then as you're running around, that clock is counting. Like, now it's 2:31, now it's 2:32, now it's 2:33.
Is that being stressful?
Yeah, yeah. And you feel like, oh, God, I'm running out of time. It's clocking me, right? Like, I got to run, and I got to do everything as fast as I can. Like, no, settle down. That's really just for flavor. What'll happen is that clock will get to 5:59, and then it'll stop until you perform an action that requires a turn, which not all actions take turns.
That's so funny about the concept of, like, oh no, I have low APM, so I'm not being optimal by not having a high APM.
Well, I was just kind of thinking, yeah. Like, you know, the clock is ticking. Like, I'm thinking like Majora's Mask style or something, where mm-hmm. it's like real time things are happening, and if I wait too long, maybe windows will close or people will move, or like, heck, what happens if I leave my game on and I go do something else? I come back and like 3 days are gonna pass. Like, no. It's really what it works like. If it's 2 p.m., that's basically like the third block of the day, you know, early morning, and afternoon or whatever. So it's just kind of for flavor. Like, they could have easily just said, like, they could have easily broken morning, the day into like
afternoon.
Morning, afternoon, evening, night or whatever. But it gives you a clock. It really is for flavor. Like, it doesn't actually mean anything. Like, I'm actually looking at my game right
now.
That's
going to stress out so many people.
Yeah, it stressed me out too. I'm thinking like that, you know, because what you want to do. Okay, so when you're exploring town, this is where the game. I think it mitigates some of the problems that Three Houses had with the, you know, routine chore. Do all these things in the city or in the monastery each day. It mitigates it to some degree, but not completely, because there are still certain events that you'll want to do relatively frequently. For example, you can train at the arena. This is sort of like the lessons in Three Houses, where you can train up every character's like weapon levels and things like that. And weapon levels are tied to skills. They're tied to different passives that you get. The higher your sword level is, the more higher chance you have to hit and have to dodge when you're wielding a sword. Different skills are available when you have higher weapon levels. If you're magic specifically, you get better magic with higher magic levels. So this is something you definitely want to do. Like, it's worthwhile. It makes you stronger. If you want to recruit characters, you'll want to talk to them, give them gifts, have meals with them, and things like that. If you want to curry favor with the gods, which each of the gods is a different boon that you can get in battle, you'll have to do that. There aren't any lost items like there were in Three Houses, if you remember the lost items, but there are like items scattered about, so you can go ahead and pick them up. These are like consumables. They're nothing super fancy. You're not going to miss out on a super good axe or something, but, you know, you get food and sometimes gifts and things like that lying around. And of course, you can check out the shops, which update after each chapter and things like that. So this is one of those things that you can do these things in the city, and you can do them once per week. You don't have to do them every week, but it is one of those things where if you're trying to like optimize every single meter you can, you will be doing this once per week. And it does become a little bit routine because you're doing it over and over again. You don't have to, but there are some parts about it that are valuable to do. And so when I was first doing this, I saw that counting clock. Yeah, for a moment, I was a little bit stressed. Like, I got to explore the city as fast as I can to save as much time as I can. Like, no, it doesn't actually matter. The clock will stop before the next action. I'm trying to think.
Okay. My other question, besides that last one, was one of the big things from Three Houses that was criticized. And obviously, you can only talk about like still the early stuff, so it's going to be hard to address. So feel free to like, you know, say, hey, I'm not sure. But like the map design, you know, like especially for battles, like a lot of them like kind of fell flat, not really as complex or as you know, thought provoking as you would want it to. It just felt like. Just a feeling of flatness through most of Three Houses. I'm just kind of interested in like where you're at right now in terms of what you can talk.
All I'll say is the skirmish battles are pretty basic. The skirmish battles are the battles you fight on the world map. That's always, you have six characters, and you're fighting in like the forest or the desert or swamp or whatever. And those are pretty flat. Sometimes you'll get like a fog of war map occasionally. But they're always, you know, defeat all the enemies, all that. Now the main battles and the paralogue battles, which I cannot talk about, there are paralogues. It's not really, that's actually not a spoiler. I can't talk about the paralogues, but I can say there are paralogues. Those battles are actually quite a bit more involved. And I guess to be vague, it feels like almost every main battle has some gimmick to it. And I mean gimmick in a positive way here. Like, there's something to it that's more than just defeat the enemies, kill the boss. There's something to it that can change the battle. Sometimes I do feel a little bit more like gimmicky in the bad way, where it's just kind of like, this is annoying to do and I'm forced to do this extra thing. But sometimes it's like an interesting, you know, twist that, like, oh, actually, here's one battle I can talk about that's early on in Leda's route that I think is a good example. This is a more of a gimmicky battle, but it really kind of changes how you approach like the tool set, the mechanics of the game. In Leda is a performer, right? And during her as she's coming to Daxian, she meets a performer from that she knows, Olympia. And Olympia is sort of like she's sort of like a jealous, like, how dare you beat me at that contest 2 years ago type of person. And like, let's have a battle or a game, a duel. And you basically do like a performance battle with her, and it's, you're lighting torches, and there's sort of like this mechanic to how these torches stay lit or not. And it's a game, and how it works is as you defeat the enemies on the map, they don't actually die, they just get like reset to a different part of the board. It almost feels like a board game in that sense. And it's like, so when you're doing this battle, it's like you want to light torches, but you also want to stop the enemies from lighting their torches. So it's you're approaching it differently than just, you know, take all their HP before I lose my HP. You have to make sure you light torches as well. That's just one example. There's actually quite a variety of different, like, it does feel a little bit more like Fate's Conquest in that way. If you remember Fate's Conquest, because different battles had some different gimmicks. In that game, like windmills and stuff, and I remember. But there's the main battles and the paralogues, I think, there's oftentimes more to it than just defeat all the enemies.
It's good to hear.
Yeah, and there's more that I wish I could talk about like how playing different routes work, but I can't.
Yeah, and of course, like, people can go read the previews of like the routes that Cullen was able to tackle, whatever he can during the embargo for that. But yeah, I mean, before we move on, you said you want to talk about the bird.
Oh yeah, so I've seen people memeing perfect bird time or whatever. So how this works is your main character is Eshmel, right? And you're kind of going back in time through these causality events to kind of witness these events of the heroic games that took place 5 years ago. And you appear in that world as a bird. You are the bird, the Pale Raven. And you can, when you're playing these routes, you can interact with the Pale Raven, and you can even feed it food and raise your support level with the Pale Raven. I'm assuming that raising your support level with the Pale Raven eventually translates to a support level with Eshmel later in the game. I'm assuming. And it works just like the tea time mechanic in Three Houses, where the character will like mumble something to themselves and you have like three dialogue choices to pick. And if you pick the one that they were expecting, you get a point. And like the more points you get, the higher, the more support level you get. And so this is one of those weekly things that you can do. It's one of those things that almost, when you're playing the heroic games, kind of feels pointless in a way, because it's like, I'm raising support level with a bird that doesn't do anything. But I kind of feel like maybe that's setting up for later. If you have multiple characters with higher support with the main character. I don't know. But yeah, so if you've seen Perfect Bird Time, that's what that's about. Is when you,
and it's like, and it's,
if you, like, do, if you interact with the bird, if you bird, pick, yeah. If you pick all three, if you pick, they ask three questions. This is just like tea time. And if you pick the same question three times, or if you pick the right answer three times in a row, you get a perfect bird time. That's what it's called. It's kind of silly.
And, so. And since you're like the bird responding, like it's not like you're a human responding. Like you can flap your wings or like chirp or whatever. It's like it's so stupid, but it's very funny. It's like, okay, this is kind of almost the logical end conclusion of like the stupidity meter of this, but to the point that it's like entertaining.
Now, one thing that's also worth mentioning is it seems like not all characters are recruitable, obviously. Those 8 characters I mentioned before, the 4 main characters and the other 4 important characters, are not like recruitable characters, at least not in this section of the game. Maybe they are way later. I don't know. I'm not that far yet. But there are also some other characters that are recruitable only to certain protagonists. I would say it feels like 85% of the character cast that you meet in Daxian, anyone can recruit. But there's just a handful of characters for each main route that you're on that are not recruitable, which sort of, in a way, it makes the game feel a little bit more like realistic. Like, for example, I think this is in the first 5 chapters for Deatrix, I'm pretty sure. Anyways, like, Deatrix actually meets Seteth relatively early on. And Seteth is also from Fodlan, we think. You know, if you play Three Houses, you know what Seteth's about, right? And Seteth is kind of basically, without getting too much into it, he's like, I've got my eye on you. I don't trust you, you know, and that means Deatrix cannot recruit Seteth. Everyone else can, but he cannot. I just kind of found that interesting. Like, there's some characters that are off limits to certain tags. Like, for example, Leda cannot recruit the boy from Brigand. I don't know why. She just can't.
I don't know if there's something you can talk about or not, but like, in terms of like recruiting characters, are there like any underlying mechanisms that you can talk about? Like,
there are strategies. Basically, it's kind of like Three Houses in that you'll see the character is sitting around town. Very, very occasionally they'll ask a question where you have to give a response, and if you give the right response, they give you get slight support with them. But that's not very frequent at all. Really, the best way to gain support with characters is to give them a gift, and then if you go to the inn, you can have meals with them. And I know Engage had meals that you could do this with. Three Houses had meals. I don't remember.
It had the cafeteria.
It's not really a cafeteria, it's more of an inn meal here. But yeah, you can invite characters that aren't in your party but are around city into meals. And that's one way to gain support with them. And there are other ways to gain support with them later, but it's after chapter 6, so I can't talk about it. But there are various mechanisms to do it. And that's...
Do you feel that this game maybe going to be too long? Like, I feel like that's one of the most universal things I heard about, like, from other outlets in the preview. It's like, this seems like a gigantic fucking game. Like, it's good that like you can like switch the routes, the heroic games protagonists in one save file. You don't have to do a new playthrough of it. But it just feels like the scope of the game just feels very large.
It is, and some of this has been revealed, and some of this I'm still not allowed to talk about specifically, so I have to be vague. So you have the premise of you're going back in time to change causality, and you have these 4 routes to deal with. I'm pretty sure I can say this. You can skip all of that if you want and go on to the second part of the game. There's a Chow mentioned this earlier. There's a big door that you can access, or it's like you can go on past this and you can skip all the routes. At the beginning of the game, you have 3 characters. You have Eshmel, you have Troy, and you have Huang Hua, which I don't know if they've really been revealed properly because they're not super involved.
They did on socials.
Yeah, I know they did. But they're not shown a whole lot because they're not really part of the heroic games. But like, I don't know how this works. I didn't do it, but you can skip the heroic games, go to the next section of the game, and I guess try to beat the game with 3 characters. That seems to be how it works. Now, like Chow said, I'm scared to try this because of the way the game auto saves. I don't know if I'm going to be stuck with that. When I did the preview call, we had a meeting, like a virtual preview meeting with like Nintendo PR when they gave us the code for these games. They basically said we recommend doing 2 routes. And that should give, that should set you up for the next part of the game. Like you have characters that you can that you pick from two different routes, and I can't get into how that works, but these characters that you recruit from these routes, you can then bring into the next part of the game. Now, like I said before, it almost feels like from a story world-building narrative standpoint, you kind of want to do all four routes, and that's not short. It takes a long time to do four routes. Yeah, I wouldn't say a single route is like the length of a full game, but it's not short either. Especially if you're going through all the map and exploring the map and things like that. And there are things I cannot say, but then like you do all these four routes, which I'm going to say it's going to take a long time. Like I probably shouldn't put an hour clock on it, but it's going to take a while. And then you have the privilege of moving on to the next part of the game, which who knows how long that is.
You might feel exhausted already. Yeah. You might already feel burned out after like, if you feel
so compelled to do. Yeah.
I was going to say, I would do like all the routes and everything, but you know, this sounds like Chrono Trigger, you know, you'll be like, oh, there's a little shiny thing where you can fight the last boss just right within the 10 minutes of the game, and you're like, should I go there?
Well, I mean, the thing with Chrono Trigger is you can beat it in a reasonable time frame.
Now, yes, there's also New Game Plus, too. Who knows, there might be a New Game Plus in this, I don't know.
Now, I have to be vague, and I promise I'm not trying to be, like, super teasy. I just know Nintendo literally listens to this stuff, so I have to be careful. I remember once... Yeah. I remember once before Mario Kart Switch 2, what's that called? World? Mario Kart World came out. I like tweeted something from the preview event and Nintendo actually messaged me and they're like, take that down. Like, sorry, I didn't realize that was off limits. So I'm not trying to be a tease. I'm trying to be careful.
It's more like we don't want to get into legal trouble.
Yeah, because I signed an NDA. But like personally, right now, I am interested enough in the events of the Heroic Games and all the people that are there that when I played one route, I was like, I want to do more because there's stuff I don't know. Like, what was up with that guy? I don't know. Like, he kind of showed up briefly in one of the routes and maybe there's more about him in other routes. And sure enough, there is. For example, one character that I found very interesting was Orkel. It looks like it's O-R-C-H-E-L, but it's pronounced Orkel. And this is like a cat mass priestess. And the first route I did, they were like very strange and weird. I'm like, what is up with that person? I'm curious about them. And I like you do Theodora's route and you kind of learn, oh, that's what's up about them. And that's just one example. So that's actually like my main motivation for doing more routes right now is like just trying to get a full picture of like, who are all these people and what are they doing here? And how does this all fit together? And yes, sometimes you get that sort of evil bad guy talking amongst themselves, very evilly kind of scenes where they're being very mysterious and you're like trying to figure out what they're up to, and sometimes you won't get the full picture of that in one route either. So that's like my motivation for like, yeah, I'm gonna go ahead and do all four routes because I don't want to move on to the next part of the game and we feel like I'm missing something, you know? Like, you can, I don't want to say like you have to do it or else you're missing out. But I feel like I'm missing out if I am. So it's kind of, it's going to be a long game. So.
And I guess the final thing that I guess is going to be a significant thing that people will want to know is are doing the initial, like, four different Heroic Games protagonists, like, from what you've seen and what from Cullen has seen, and you guys, you know, obviously compare notes, does it feel repetitive going from one to the other? Does it feel like, hey, I feel like I'm doing the same adventures with a different crew? Or does it feel significantly different from one another?
The stories and the battles themselves are pretty different. There are some like shared battles, but the main story and the main battles and the motivation for being there, those are all different. However, when it comes to like exploring the map, that's where it gets, and exploring Dagzy in the city, that's where it gets a little bit rote, where... Like, if I'm on my third playthrough, it's like, I've already been all over the map. I guess I'm exploring the map again, you know, for the third time.
And the locations of that map and, like, the resource locations or whatever you need at that map, does it stay static then?
I gotta be careful what I say. It's the same map each time.
Okay.
So that's where it feels a little bit rote.
Okay.
So, like, I think that's sort of unavoidable. Unless you gave each character a brand new map, when you're on your third or fourth playthrough and you're exploring the map again, it's the same map. There's only so much you can do with it.
Yeah. Okay.
Any other questions? Like, I It's going to be a long game.
I think you got them all. Yeah. Like I was thinking, like, I didn't know a whole lot about the Ishmael character, but you kind of explained it with the bird discussion. You talked about the framing of the game, and Josh brought up the battle challenges, or like the map design, because that was like the one thing that not everyone agreed, of course, that, you know, Engage did do pretty well. And Three Houses often came up kind of short. So it's interesting to see that, you know, I know you haven't finished or anything, but you've seen some pretty interesting stuff there. The framing of the game in terms of how it does and doesn't relate to Three Houses is pretty interesting. I think it seems like they're playing it pretty careful that it doesn't feel like Three Houses is a requirement. But, you know, if you have played it, you're going to recognize terms, names, and places, which I think is always fun. That's like the good sort of fan service, right? That, you know, gives a little something for people to say, like, oh, I recognize this place or this character. Oh, this person has the same crest as Dimitri or whatever. That's interesting.
I do have one comment. I know... This is a little bit outside of my tastes, I guess. I know a lot of people might approach Fire Emblem sort of like tactical RPG dating sim because of Awakening and Engaged to some degree had Marriage, and, you know, Three Houses at the very end had like sort of like pair up.
The face rubbing
thing. Yeah, that too. I feel like the support system in this game is pretty far removed from the romance stuff from the previous game. So if you're coming to Fire Emblem primarily for romance, it's kind of taken a back seat here, which sort of makes sense because you're playing as four different characters who have, you're like, none of them are your avatar, really. Like, maybe Ishmael can have a romance later, I don't know. But, like, you know, when Kai is supporting with his cast, or Dietrich, he's not a romantic guy, and, like, there's a little bit. But it doesn't really feel like dating sim. Like it kind of feels more like a Tellius game to me, where the supports are more like explaining, like, you know, character backgrounds and maybe like other interactions based on like their different statuses or different reasons for being there or things like that. For example, in Dietrich's route, he meets Esmeralda, who sort of gets like a puppy crush on Dietrich, but and she calls him sweetie. But it's not really like, it doesn't feel like a romance. But she also meets a different character named Michaela, who's like a mom, and she's got like a mother, kind of like a mother-daughter sort of relationship going on there. And, you know, I just kind of feel like the support system in the game leans a little bit less away from like the dating sim style of it, which is totally fine by me. Like, I actually kind of prefer the sort of character building, world building kind of idea. But, you know, it doesn't feel like Awakening, where you're like pairing up characters to be a pair.
But you say that now. You say that now until like you get to like the avatar.
Yeah, maybe the avatar at the end will be able to romance.
Yeah, with the world, like it's like the world of Ruin, and like there's red skies, and then you see like you finally get the S support with Dietrich or Leda, and you see like the avatar like face rubbing them while everyone's dying in the background. It's like, oh, this is the greatest love story of all time.
Mechanically, I will also mention that any character can mechanically support any other character. It's kind of like it's kind of like Radiant Dawn in that way, actually. However, only certain pairs have support conversations.
Okay.
So like Leda can support, you know, Mu, who is a character in her group, and they have support conversations, and it'll also bolster them in battle when they're next to each other, of course. But she can also support any other character that you recruit, and they may or may not have support conversations. So, you know, there's a both mechanical element to it and a character element to it.
I know this might be a little early to say, but how do the support conversations feel? And this is painting with a broad brush, I get it. But it felt like in Three Houses, there was kind of like some of them were very, you know, political or, you know, controversial, or they had like the world building behind them. And then you had a few that were for fun or for flavor, or just kind of like two people getting along. But then in Engage, it felt way more towards the latter, where it was just like, I don't like spicy food, I should cook spicy. Like, it felt like different scales of like seriousness. Like, I don't know if you can talk about how you feel about the support conversations you've seen so far.
That was actually in my review of Engage, that the characters in the game were so one note, and that was everything they ever talked about was that. It was like, I love training, or I love food, and it was just, like, every support conversation.
I have singular character traits.
Yeah, every support conversation, like, revolved around that, and it was so tedious. This game, Definitely not. Now, when you have, you know, 30 characters you can recruit or something like that, of course there's going to be some, you know, exaggerated gimmicks or whatever, right? There always is in Fire Emblem, but it feels more like Three Houses, where like, all right, different characters have personalities and can actually hold a conversation and have perspectives and viewpoints, and things like that. You know, some characters are of course more silly than others, but and the support conversations are never all too long either, which I kind of like. But you know, they're just kind of very bits and pieces of character, you know, building and character interaction.
And there's no limit to them, right? I don't think there's been a limit to supports in a while.
I don't think so. Checking. Yeah,
right. It's been a while since they've been limited. So cool.
Did you want to ask something earlier?
I was here. Yes, I was trying to ask. It's like it's still the same way of like you have to build up S rank supports, is it?
I think right now I can only see up to A rank. S rank might show up later. Yeah,
it's kind of typical, right?
Yeah. Which, if the game is as long as we expect it to be, it makes sense that like you can't get an S rank support in the heroic game section, because the heroic game section is only the first part of the game. What comes after, I don't know.
And you're not being coy. You generally don't know because you're stuck playing the
same route. I guess I can probably say I'm in the middle of my third playthrough, like third route. So yeah. I don't know what happens after this, after these heroic games.
I also have one more question. Okay, so all the characters had like special like world abilities. I think Nintendo showed this.
Oh, I should have mentioned this. This is actually very good. I should have mentioned this. So one way in which characters feel a little different from each other is they do different things on the world. Really, thank you for mentioning this. I'm almost kind of feel embarrassed that I almost didn't. So when you're playing through your free time, you get quests, and regular quests are, you know, these are similar to the like Three Houses, where it asks you to like, can you get this item for me? And the item might be in a dungeon somewhere, and it kind of points you to it, like the item's over here, or can you fight these enemies over in this part of the map, and you do that. So those are like regular quests that any character gets, but each character seems to have unique types of quests for them as well, that kind of involves what they can do on the map. For example, Leda, as a performer, she will get performance quests requests, and it'll be like, can you go to this town on the map over here and do a performance? And if you do that, you get money, you get items, you get renown, and I guess the challenge here is making sure you have enough time left in your free time to head over there and do the performance and kind of map these things out. Theodora, since she's at the heroic games to kind of bolster her kingdom, which is like a small fledgling kingdom, she can send supplies home. And when she's on the world map, she can actually have like garrisons on the map, like collecting supplies for her. And you'll get requests like, hey, can you send home 30 types of fish or 30 fish items? And you can do that. And that gives her money and renown and whatnot. Dietrich, he gets like dual requests. And it's like, fight me. And so you fight some guy, and that gives you money and renown. And there's also some mechanics that vary here. For example, do you remember the gambits in Three Houses, where you'd like you'd get like a squad of characters like in a certain formation that you could use twice or three times a battle? Do you remember those?
Yep.
Theodora has those.
I remember.
Nobody else has those. That's a Theodora thing. So that makes her feel different in battle and whatnot. And these gambits are also what you use to collect supplies in the world map. Dietrich, what he can do is when he fights these duels that he's you know challenged to, he can upgrade his combat arts and get stronger combat arts. No one else has access to that. And I don't know exactly what Kai's is. Like, Kai's I haven't done yet. And Leda doesn't. Like, Leda gets access to the. This is a very slight spoiler and maybe technically breaking embargo, but she gets access to the dancer class eventually, and she's the only one who does, which if you've seen the
that's obvious,
right? No, like,
over the YouTube.
Yeah, so she gets access to the dancer class, which does what a normal dancer does in Fire Emblem. I don't know if she really has anything that's equivalent to like a gambit or a this combat art upgrading, though. She gets a lot more renown than other characters. And I haven't talked about renown yet. Okay, renown, very quickly. Renown is a meter that you fill up by going through the story, doing quests, doing these performance quests or supply sending quests or whatnot, and fighting enemies. And the higher your renown will go up from like level 1 to level 2 to level 3 all the way up to level 12. And the higher your renown, the more options become available in Daxian, the city. And also, like, more items will be available at the shop. And your meal time that you have at the inn will be more effective. Or your training at the arena will be more effective. And so it basically is kind of like a global, like almost like a city level in a sense. It's how well you're known in the city. And the higher your renown, kind of the more bonuses you get. So this is kind of like a kind of a global level that you're raising, progressing through, that over time kind of gives you more and more perks throughout the game. And like I said, Leda can raise this by doing performances. Theodora raises this by sending supplies home. Deatrice by fighting people. And I don't really know how Kai does it yet. I haven't done Kai yet. So sorry about that. I should have mentioned those earlier.
There's a lot to talk about. I mean, it's crazy to see how far, like how many layers there are in the series now compared to, you know, GBA era.
And some character, and actually, when you're looking at a character's like recruitment requirements, many characters will have a renown requirement. Actually, I think every character has a renown requirement, where like this character will not join you unless you have at least 7 renown. So there are certain characters that are more easy to get because they are, you know, they only need 1 or 2 or 3 renown that you can get early on in the game. And there are some that you kind of have to wait till later because you have to boost your renown first before they'll even think about joining you. And a lot of characters also have like a secondary, I guess, task that you have to do to recruit them. Some characters ask for money. Some characters ask for like certain items. Like, for example, they'll ask for an iron bow or whatever. Some characters ask you to do an extra fight somewhere. So each character recruitment's a little bit different.
Yep.
Any last questions on Fire Emblem Fortune's Weave?
I think the thing that people are at least universally like agreed upon in terms of like just what's been released so far about this game is that so far all the music samples they've released are really strong. Very good.
Yep. Each character has different main battle theme. It kind of suits the character. Deatrice's is very edgelordy. Leda's is very dancey and fanciful in a way. The battles during the heroic games have like their own music. The qualifiers have a different music than the main matches. The final match, I know this is outside of my preview embargo, but the final match music is unique and very cool. The music is great.
I want to buy this OST right now. I just don't want to download the Nintendo app to like listen to it.
I'm sure they're up on YouTube, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, I think they're probably gone by now. I remember like the video had like a hilarious name. This is not Blaze. And the comment section is like, it's like, hey, thanks for teaching me how to do my makeup in my war games or something.
Well, Adam, thank you for going to such, you know, detailed lengths. And I know putting the preview together was a combined effort between you and Cullen, and I do definitely want to shout out that you guys put a written preview up accompanying, you know, what you talked about on the podcast on the site as well. So I know Cullen also is in the same boat as you, who has played a few other different routes, and reading his impressions, you know, behind the scenes has been pretty fun as well. So I think this game is going to be a big one, and it's only about a month away. So again, thank you for taking the time to go through it in so much detail for the podcast. All right, the only other game I had to talk about here was the little section that I earmarked out for Beast of Reincarnation. Very short, because I know you guys went to full length with Hayes last week, and you talked about the review on the site for it, but I wasn't here, and I also played it. So, and I've also not listened to last week's podcast, so I have no idea. Like,
you also are playing it with a new patch as well. We played it pre-patch.
I think I played it both before and after the patch. Just, you know, I started it when it released, but I just finished it like 2 days ago. And I didn't really like, it didn't really affect my playthrough a lot. Cause the patch was a little bit for like, you could change your interact key. Cause it had the Final Fantasy 15 problem that interact and jump are set to the same button. So if you're not quite at the thing, you jump instead of picking up the item or whatever. And they made some text changes or whatever. Also not really related to Beast of Reincarnation. One thing that I have never tried, but I did try with this game is that, Was Mikhail here last week? Did he talk about it at all?
I don't think he was here last.
All right. Because Beast Reincarnation does not work well on Steam Deck. I believe he wrote up something saying that. But yeah. But so what I did is I just streamed it to my Steam Deck from my main PC, just like across the house. And that actually worked surprisingly well. That's the first time I did like the in-house streaming. And I'm like, oh, actually, this is kind of nice if I want to play it like in the bed or in couch, on the couch from my main PC. So not really related to Beast Reincarnation specifically, but it was a neat, neat that our internet infrastructure is getting to the point that not, obviously not everyone has the same access, but that sort of thing can be a viable option come far from the days of OnLive. And also that was local and not, you know, from a server somewhere several states away. Anyways. So, Beast Reincarnation, I know I'm just going to give this like a very quick impression because I'm coming in after the fact. In terms of how this game plays, I think it's decent to good. Like combat, progression, itemization, like all those sorts of things. This game isn't the best there ever was, but I really don't have any issues or concerns with it. It's flashy, combos are fun. I think the environments are decent, if a little bit samey. That's not where I think this game falters. Where it falters, I think, is the story, which you might say, well, that's the part I care least about. But like, it's bad enough that even though I don't play a lot of games for the story primarily, I was like, I don't understand what's going on, or this doesn't make sense, or I'm not attached to this in any like emotional or sympathetic way. That's where I feel like if I talk about, like if I were to write a review on this, I would say like, this is where the game really falls over, I think, is the story and the narrative, because, and I guess it ties into the gameplay, right? Because you can't divorce the two things completely, because the game is divided into like chapters, and each chapter is basically a zone. And for the first like 12 or 13, for the first like half of the game, you basically go from zone to zone, and you're not really told anything. You're just like, well, we'll discuss that later, or once you realize, you'll have to make your own decision. Like really vague, like just nothing burgers of like, gee, isn't this mysterious? Like, yes, it's mysterious. Please stop stringing me along. And like, no, you've got three more chapters of being strung along. I was like, okay, fine.
That's one of my least favorite storytelling tropes, where it's like, you know nothing and you're an idiot. It's like, well, tell me something. No.
Nope. Bye.
Got that from Trails Too Much. It's like, what is this plan? I
did play through it again on New Game Plus for achievements, because I'm brain-pilled. But like, it's not like I play through it again. I'm like, oh, they were teasing things, or wow, this was like a really smartly laid trail of breadcrumbs. Like, no, it really wasn't that either. It was just like, we're being mysterious for mysterious' sake. And they also use like terms like interchangeably in ways that I'm not sure if it's profound or just sloppy. That's the thing. There's a lot of things about this game where I'm like, I'm not sure these two story like elements are compatible with each other. Either it's supposed to be like this profound, really like deep thing, or it's this thing that they just were just kind of like, that idea seems neat, put that in there. That idea seems neat, put that in there as well. Do those two ideas mesh with each other? Maybe not, but go with it. Like, they call the main character Emma, who partners up with a dog named Koo. Early in the game, they call her like a sealer, and she's tasked to go from zone to zone, defeating these giant creatures called Nushi as they make their way to the capital. But then it feels like after a few chapters, they start calling her Purifier instead. I'm like, is that the same title? Are those two different titles? Or did they just not decide what they wanted to call her? Like, I could not tell if it was profound or sloppy. And then you partner up with another character named Brad, and Brad is working with other characters and is like using you and stringing you along. And eventually he kind of reveals to you, like, this is like chapter 7 or 8, like what's really going on. And you're like, oh, I get it. Like, this was all a farce, or this was upending my preconceptions. And then, but before you can really digest what's revealed to you at that time, it happens again, like the next chapter, like, here's what's really, really going on. I'm like, wait, I haven't fully digested the first one. And I'm not sure those two things you revealed to me back to back are compatible with each other. Like, and that happens a few times towards the ending, where I'm just like, I don't understand who was on whose side. And I feel kind of dumb admitting that, because some people are like, no, it was obvious. Like, clearly, didn't you understand it? Like, I think it might have been a good story poorly told, if that makes sense. Like, if maybe they had spaced it out a little bit more metered throughout the progression of the game and not so backloaded it, maybe I could have seen it. But there's certain things that the revelations that happen through the end of the game, I just don't understand if they're compatible with each other, if that makes sense. And then I think the other failing of the story is that there's a character called Kagura, who's like a little girl that you rescue early on, who's supposed to be kind of like a driving force for Emma, in terms of like grounding her to her humanity, you know, something worth fighting for, that sort of stuff. But I think the reason this the story fails is that Kagura is just basically a nothing character that you don't feel a lot of sympathy for. This is a weird comparison, but Josh, did you watch G-Quux?
Yes.
So Tsuji is a character in G-Quux who drives a lot of the story, but Tsuji is a bad character. That's my opinion. And
I agree.
I think there's like, general consensus.
Oh, you watched it too? Yeah. And it's like, yes, a lot of the later part of that show is driven by Tsuji or characters that care a lot about Tsuji. It feels sort of similar to that. Like, I gotta care about Kagura. Emma cares about Kagura. But I don't give a shit about her. And I've probably that's a little bit crass, but I'm just like, she basically is a character who's about, I don't know, 10-ish, 12-ish, who you rescue, who doesn't really have a home. And she basically cooks food for you. Like, that's her like gameplay mechanic. And then throughout the whole game, she's just like, I learned how to cook omelets. I can't wait to share it with you. Today, I had the very perfect apple pie. I can't wait to see the smile on your face when you try it out. And then the next, you know, 5 minutes later, I think we should try something with carrots. Like, it's just like, I don't care about any of this. Like, she has no like depth. Like, she's a one trick, like a one note pony, and that one note is not that interesting.
Yeah, I'll give you a comparison on this, because what you're describing is definitely like Tsuji and G-Quux, where like you've made them the center point of a lot of like your plot threads, but you haven't really supplemented the characters, like anything about them besides like very facetious surface level introductory stuff. Like, you don't really go into the meat of like, why is this person like this, and where did they come from? They're very deliberately enigmatic, but you don't actually fill in why you've made them deliberately enigmatic, and you've made them the focal point of a lot of these plot threads. Where it comparison of like why this is of another example where this is done well. It's like Sunny from the Metal Gear Solid series, where Sunny is not necessarily the focus character for a lot of plot threads, but you do have a reason to care about Sunny, especially in MGS4, and how her character arc develops in that, because you have the backstory of her from her mother Olga from MGS2, so you can actually make the connection of like, why is where is Sunny coming from because of Olga's fate in MGS2. So you do at least have something to work with of why you care about Sunny, and Sunny's not like the main focal point of the MGS plot threads, but there she does factor in enough where a certain portion of MGS's plot threads feel complete because of Sunny and their relationship to the related characters in those ongoing.
I've not played MGS, but that sounds like a decent comparison. Because yeah, basically, Kagura doesn't have like the enigmatic stuff that Tsuji has, but it's like you should care about this character. Emma, the protagonist, really cares about or grows to really care about her. But then you're like 60, 70, 80% of the game, you're like, but I don't care about her. Like, not really. She's not giving me a reason to really care about her. And I think they could have just given her more to do or more topics to talk about, not make her so one trick, one note on one thing, which is basically cooking. And I don't think I played in English. I don't think her English voice acting helps, even though that's a little bit more, you know, I don't think the character design, I think, fails regardless of how she's voiced or in what language. It's just she's not an interesting character. And I know that's an opinion thing. Someone might really love her, but because she is central to so many plot threads, and maybe not central, but she's a driving force for Emma. And because you don't end up feeling anything positive about her, it makes the rest of the game not come together. And that's basically where I think, If I wanted this game to be reviewed better or like received better, or I know Game Freak has said like, you know, we're sorry that we haven't met your expectations, we're working on it. I'm like, well, that would require like redoing this script, like not just bug fixes or tweaks or gameplay shifts. Like, fundamentally, what you've laid down here is not interesting. That I think is my personal hang. And I'm not saying the game is bad. You know, you talk about like there's this almost like what's the word? like this idea that's almost trite at this point, like 7 out of 10 games are the most interesting types of games. And it's almost just like it doesn't mean anything anymore. This feels like a game that is a few points under that, like not in terms of like literally 5 or 7 out of 10, but it's like this game could have been like a endearing, fun little passion project from a studio that doesn't make games like this. And even though it's rough around the edges, it has a lot of heart. Like, could have been that perfect quote unquote 7 out of 10 game that some people really love. But to me, it just doesn't quite meet that bar. It's really just kind of like I kind of see what they're going for, but it doesn't come together. It's okay. That's kind of where I'm at. So yeah, that's my little touch in on Beast of Reincarnation. I'm not disappointed and I played it, but I was like, I was hoping for more and didn't quite get there. But I do like the combat, which is maybe that's the most important thing. Like, the combat is actually pretty good. It's pretty easy though. All right, those are the two games we're going to talk about. Let's go into kind of our news and article rundown here. As I mentioned at the top of the podcast, the Steins Gate reboot review embargo has lifted. That game releases near the end of the month, in 5 days, on August 20th at the time of recording. We'll let James speak to it at a future opportunity when he's back on the podcast, because he wrote the review. But the review for Steins Gate reboot is up on the site, rpgsite.net, as well as Mikhail's PC handheld kind of technical rundown for it. And I'll just say that James ended up feeling pretty strongly about it. He scored it pretty well. But a lot of that, when you read through his review, is mainly about availability of, like, if you wanted to get into the series, this one is kind of convenient. And I don't know enough about Steins Gate to, like, speak to that at length, but it feels like if you wanted to play another version of this story, your options are a lot more limited. Is that true?
Yeah, I recently reread the original Steins Gate on PC, and the original version is largely only on PC in the West. And to even play that version well, you have to install like an optional fan-made patch that like makes the fonts more readable, because the original font styling wasn't great. And the original version, well, it's very divisive in the community, but in my opinion, is the best version, because it kind of gives the full the whole entire script of the story, where future versions, including the Elite remake and now this reboot remake, which is based on the Elite remake, does cut down the script, because it sort of speeds along some of the more like pseudoscience explanations of like the time travel stuff in itself, where it kind of cuts out a lot of that pseudoscience explanations, some of the slice of life stuff, and like the Ferris Rod in particular has a lot of like parts of its script cut out in the Elite and now the reboot scripts, because Ferris's Rod largely focuses around like this card, I forgot if it's like a card game, but it's particular to her story only, which may people feel some way about that. So, you know, if you like the story cuts made in Elite, and not to say that like it cuts like the meat of the story, like the entire meat of the story is still there, it's just like a lot of the what maybe people consider fluff or maybe too long-winded. If you prefer like the more streamlined pacing of Elite, you'll enjoy Reboot, because it is from that same basis. James's review is more focused on like what Reboot is presented at the table, not necessarily trying to reinvent the wheel of like, hey, did you, you know, this isn't about like whether you prefer the original or Elite. It's more so what does Reboot add to the table, and what he came away with, as you mentioned, Brian, is like this is kind of the best modern way to play this game, because it's going to be readily accessible on modern platforms, not just PC, which does come out in that August 20th release date, but on other console platforms, which will be, I think, later in October. For the Western releases of those.
Oh, good call on that. Yeah, sometimes our site, our little release date sidebar doesn't clearly show by, it just says August 20th, because that's the first one, right? So, you know, good shout.
Mm-hmm. So, and Steins Gate is, you know, considered like one of the strongest like entries in the science adventure series for mages, and to a lot of people, their favorite visual novel of all time. So it's like it's still that story. It's still an amazing tale. Like whether you feel the original was better or the least, you know, more streamlined version is better. This adds on more in terms of like it present. It still has like the same original artist for the original, but obviously that artist has, you know, grown and evolved their art style over time. So it does still it looks way different than the original version because they were at a much earlier point in their career. But now it also adds like animated like portraits to them in terms of like their facial expressions. It's a more live 2D animation style, but it also has like really funny ways it supplements it. Like for example, there's a character named Moeka from Steins Gate that is really she's very she doesn't speak a lot, but she's a very fast texter. She's very good at texting you a lot and very fast. So how they present this in Reboot from some of the footage that they've shown in prior like developer streams is that her finger is just going moving at light speed during her idle animation, for example, because she always has her phone, she's always texting. So the way that you know show that she's a fast texter is her thumb is just you can barely see her thumb because it's moving so fast. It is a very funny like way to present that character and this evolved game engine that they're using. Different presentation, which is fun. So I'm
that is pretty fun.
Yeah, so I'm very excited to you know pick this up and read it. I'm like less so reading it because I've already read it very recently, but more so like see what the presentation looks like. And obviously there are some story elements in it that have not been shown in prior releases of Steins Gate, the game itself. It's like it's adapting like one of like the fan, not the fan disc, but like one of the stories that's been presented like in a Japan exclusive drama disc or whatever. I forgot even. But I want to check that out too. So definitely go read James's review for his thoughts on it. And I'm very curious to see, you know, how I feel about it. Get around to reading.
And we might discuss it at length, maybe after it releases here on the podcast, if we find a good window for it. So
yeah.
A little bit of preview there and showing that, yeah, the review is up on the site, and some kind of initial impressions from James and a recap of some of the things they've added, from the pre-release information and comparisons to, you know, the other available entries of the game.
I think it is worth mentioning, like, if you do plan on reading Reboot on Steam Deck, maybe wait for Spike Chunsoft or Mages to release a patch for it, because apparently on Steam Deck, the voices don't play right now on Reboot for whatever reason. James has, like, a Windows handheld, and the voices work fine on that, but apparently on just Linux, like, running it on there just disables the voices for whatever reason.
Weird. Okay. Good, Kyle. Another article that went up on the site this last week is a preview. This is for another August release. This is Star Wars Zero Company. Scott went ahead and put up this preview for us about half a week ago. The game releases on PC, Xbox, and PlayStation 5 on August 27th. Scott's preview for this, you can go on the site and read it if you're interested. Primarily focuses on the characters because, you know, the game is being developed by Bitreactor. It has already been very, very, you know, cleanly compared to games like XCOM, things like that. But Scott's preview, honestly, like doesn't talk about the gameplay a ton. Talks mostly about the camaraderie between the cast and, you know, how the dialogue flows and stuff like that, and really endeared themselves to Scott. And I don't know how big of a Star Wars fan Scott is, but he really enjoyed it, and that was his main takeaway from his preview opportunity there. So have that on the site if you're interested. And I know I have a brother who's actually a big Star Wars fan who's going to be playing this. So maybe I'll kind of poke my head in and be like, hey, you know, how's that strategy game that, you know, releases in the end of the month? Are you picking it up? And maybe I'll have a few. Like, I'm not planning to play it myself, yeah. But I'm interested to see how it does. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm definitely planning to pick this up. Assuming that, like, the PC launch is going to be relatively fine. If it's, like, game-breaking or a lot of bugs, maybe I'll hold off.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm crossing my fingers that it isn't. But it's been a lot of fun seeing Scott's preview and also other outlets' previews. Like for some video previews, they showed like the extensive like Stormtrooper customization, like different helmets and like a whole Like, you can basically have a full paint job, custom paint job on a whole full, like, stormtrooper squad if you want to run that, which is a lot of fun. So it seems like all this game is like a very cool, like, sandbox of, like, creating, like, your own dream Star Wars team that's not necessarily just Jedi focused. Mm-hmm. And it's cool that, like, some of the story scenes that they showed off in, like, the video previews, it like, it does have, like, a very, like, compelling conversations, like, natural flow to it that sometimes can be stiff in other licensed, you know, takes and on video game licensed games. And apparently, like, the narrative side of Zero Company, I believe, like, one of the individuals who's heading it up worked on the Jedi Fallen Order, Jedi Survivor, I think. Those games, the third-person Souls-like-esque game.
So go ahead and give that preview a read, and hopefully by the end of the month we'll have a chance to talk about the full release once it comes out in just a couple weeks. And then the last feature we have on the site is the Elder Scrolls IV Oblivion Remastered launching on Switch 2. Did that actually launch on Switch 2, or is it upcoming? I forget. I looked that up. Switch 2 release date? August 11th. So yes, it is available. Okay. Mikhail, like, I don't want to speak for him, but since he's not here, I'll do it to a small extent. He actually seemed relatively positive on the Switch 2 performance on Oblivion Remastered, saying that most of the issues are kind of like issues that are not uncommon to the other versions of the game. Just like, it's more just the game itself struggling with Unreal Engine and didn't release on the other consoles in a great state, and it's just kind of more of the same on Switch 2. But really thought that it supported, like, the mouse, you know, the mouse Joy-Cons and a few other things, and really felt like a pretty decent port. Apparently, though, if you have your Switch 2 go to sleep, the in-game clock doesn't stop. So if you care about, like, accurate clock time, that is something that currently is not fixed on Switch 2 version of the game. But yeah, it still has, like, hitching and stutters, and it's one of those things where it's like, I guess that's just how that game is. I played it on PC last year, and yep, that's how it was for me too. I don't know if they've really patched up the
it feels like it hasn't, because people I feel like the overwhelming response to anytime this remastered gets Oblivion remastered gets brought up is please patch it. So it feels like it doesn't matter what platform it is. It seems like the universal response from any player on any platform this game was released on was please patch it.
I forget if it was GOG officially or someone just linking to GOG. Like, and I think you can get on Steam too, right? Like, by the way, the 2006 version of the game runs on a toaster and has a bunch of mods, and that version also can be prettied up if you want. Of course, you know, only if you're into that sort of thing, I suppose, but it is still playable. But I enjoyed Oblivion, but it seems like for Switch 2, it doesn't run great, but it runs okay. That's Mikhail could go into more detail, but that's my one sentence.
It is technically serviceable and can be played to completion.
Yes. All right. Into our, like, headline news section here. Not a lot of news in general, but we'll go through it. We are recording this basically a day or so after. I don't follow Disney stuff a lot, but the D23 fan event, where they talk about, obviously, new movies, new Disney Plus shows, but there's always that little bit of an intersection with, you know, what about Kingdom Hearts, right? And that obviously is in our site's purview as well. So we were expecting to see something about Kingdom Hearts at this event, because they said that Haley Joel Osment and some of the other, you know, actors were going to be there in some capacity. And I think they basically said, like, hey, we're going to talk about Kingdom Hearts, so pay attention if you're into that sort of thing. I'm like, all right, I guess we will. So they did show off a new trailer for Kingdom Hearts 4, and they even gave us a release window. So we last saw Kingdom Hearts 4, was it back in June, where we talked about that weird, interesting kind of trailer that showed Sora fighting Darkseid in the city environment and a few other things. Well, this one, because it's a Disney focus event, they focused on what Disney worlds are going to be shown in Kingdom Hearts 4, and they showed off the world of Pixar's Coco, including, you know, a new outfit for Sora, just some events from the movie being shown off in the game. And this is actually a movie I have not seen. So I'm like, oh no, I'm behind. I haven't seen this, like, 9-10-year-old movie at this point.
Me too, yeah. It's like a 2017 movie, and apparently it's pretty good. So I was like, oh, I just...
I mean, that was me with Frozen and Kingdom Hearts 3. Like, I've never seen this movie. I've heard about a lot about it.
I've never really heard about Coco, unlike Frozen. Like Frozen felt like a cultural phenomenon.
Yeah, it did. Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's cool. I like this unexpected pick because I've never heard of it. It seems well regarded, and like it makes me want to go see the film.
Mm-hmm. And this maybe it was the Disney part of it, like shining through, or it's a known IP property at this point. But I feel like this was a slightly better showing than the previous one. But it does of course have some of the more overarching, you know,
yeah,
what the premise of Kingdom Hearts 4, like gotta save Sora because he disappeared from the world we know and he's now in this other place and has characters from the other tie-in mobile games. Like we knew Strelitzia was gonna appear.
Yeah.
Sigurd, who's this other character from Union Cross that I don't know anything about, but he makes an appearance. Go ahead.
Yeah, I don't know why, but I kind of actually chuckled when I hear like Haley Gola Osment yelling like Strelitzia.
Yeah, me too.
the more casual Kingdom Hearts fan, and we're like, who are these people? And like Google what Kingdom Hearts Wiki Sigurd, like who is this person?
Yeah, and also because like that, like they're like their names are like you hear you're used to Sora saying Donald and Goofy.
Yeah.
So like it's Kyrie. that's fine. Or Kyrie Riku.
Yeah.
But like a name like Strelitzia is like, it's fucking three syllables, man. It's like, oh, Strelitzia. It's like,
I guess what? Four syllables.
Yeah. Like, what? But I agree that there's a stronger trailer. I think that also comes down to like, hey, we actually have a Disney world to look at so you can see its environments, how it's rendered in the game. And it like, and it seems like the world of Coco is a very vibrant, colorful world. So you get to see like different like ways you explore that environment. There's more going on, and like just generally just a very more a colorful experience, you know. And you get to see like that world's themed Keyblade design as well, and some of the heartless that show up in it, which is cool, which is very Kingdom Hearts. The other things that, you know, you showed off in the trailer, it's very very teased that is like Mickey's in some library going, oh, there's a lot to this, huh? Really, really strange.
And then you Hades is here for some reason.
Yeah, like Donald and Goofy are visiting Hades because they believe that Sora went to the underworld.
Yeah,
because like when he disappeared, and Hades is like, nope, hasn't shown up, and you're like, what? And then of course the weirdest part of this trailer is Sora somehow like sees Donald and Goofy's like holograms, maybe hallucinating them. Who knows? But look, whatever hallucinations are of these holograms of Donald and Goofy that Sora is seeing in this now quote-unquote real world setting, has seeing those has like caused it like faint, like, oh god, there's like fucking frying my brain. Very enigmatic.
They did show a little bit of gameplay. It still feels a bit like press X to awesome, but that's kind of Kingdom Hearts in one sentence at this point. And of course, just a short little gameplay snippets from a trailer. Who knows what you can pull from that? I did see one funny little account where it was like, hell, and it shows a picture of Hades, and then hell, Mexico, and it shows a picture of like Coco, or, you know, playing their instruments and having a party. Like, okay.
Yeah. And the important part of this was we finally got a release window for this, which is late 2027. And we have official confirmation. I forgot this was confirmed before, but this will be launching simultaneously on multiple platforms for everything. PS5, mm-hmm. Xbox Series, Switch 2, and PC via Steam and Xbox on PC and Epic Games Store. So there's no weird staggered release now of like, this is going to PlayStation console, first, then Xbox, Epic Games Store. Then, yeah. This is not... That is finally... You know, one of the big things with this whole Square Enix overhaul strategy that they've been working on for years now is the fruition of that. Of course, FF7 Revelation as well is the same deal, where that'll be launching simultaneously on multiple platforms. And it's just one of those things that's like, it seems like next year is going to be a very, very strong year for Square Enix because of that strategy. And these long-awaited, anticipated projects finally releasing. Hopefully, crossing fingers that it doesn't get delayed again. But also, I like 2027 is also going to be a weird, almost twilight year where it could very well be like the final year that games will be released on physical media that's like widely adopted, mainly Blu-ray. Of course, we may still get physical releases for like Switch 2 moving on to 2028. But, you know, so Sony cutting off, you know, the PlayStation physical side of things is still a tremendous blow to the entire industry. And there's nothing that will quite, you know, fill in that void. But it's not the only Kingdom Hearts thing that was announced, right, Brian?
Right. They announced, and some people say this was long overdue, a new Disney Plus series called Kingdom Hearts the series, right? Do I have that right? Just Kingdom Hearts the series?
They said series, Nakamura, maybe?
I think it's just, let me pull this up. What is it?
Kingdom Hearts anime.
Just Kingdom Hearts the series.
Yep. Okay.
And I like, some people say this is long overdue. It seems to be an original story, but I don't know if they've gone into a lot of detail. They showed a little bit of a like a key art with a character, a keyblade wielder facing the back towards, like, you know, the camera, so to speak. People already say, like, what keyblade is that? It looks like this person's keyblade from some mobile game I haven't played, from Dark Road or something like that. So people are already like speculating past the level that I'm knowledgeable about. Like, do we know the character in the teaser? And at the point, since this was announced basically, you know, a day ago, maybe on the Kingdom Hearts, you know, forums, they've already sussed out who this is. But at the time it was announced, it seemed to be a new character, but people are trying to dig up everything they can. About
the official description for this that they've put out for this is, it's developed in partnership with Tetsuya Nomura and Square Enix. This series reimagines the iconic adventure with a brand new story that will expand on the universe of Kingdom Hearts while celebrating the characters that have captured the hearts of millions of fans around the world. So from their own words, they call it a reimagining of the iconic adventure, and it's a brand new story. So who knows what that means, you know? But I, you know, there's a lot of, like, the theories of, like, you know, what could this be? Maybe there are parts of, like, Missing Link, that canceled mobile game, that will maybe make their way into this series. Who knows? Once again, but they call it a reimagining with a brand new story. That's all we know.
I saw some people saying, like, clearly this is going to be required viewing if you want to understand what happens in Kingdom Hearts 4.23 or whatever.
Who knows? Like, I feel like almost certainly, because this whole series is like consistent with that. Even though they call it, you know, reimagining, it's a brand new story. Who knows if they never said it exists in isolation, you know. But I imagine they're making this for a reason, but who knows? Yeah, I mean, we'll see. We'll see. But other than that, we don't know what the animation studio is. We don't know, like, we don't know the staff working on it aside from, like, hey, Nomura and Square Enix is involved, obviously, but we don't know the actual studio and their staff producing this new show.
I think that was it for Kingdom Hearts, but, you know, just another 2027 release for Square Enix. So early in the year, Final Fantasy VII Revelation. Is it Revelation? Yeah.
Yeah.
And then later in the year, Kingdom Hearts. So Nomura bookends the year, basically.
I really thought they would come out much later than that, but well, good on them. 2027.
I would hope that they finally, like, you know, we're gonna release this. Like, they can't. We don't want another Kingdom Hearts 2 to 3 situation. There's like the journey it took to get there.
I think the worst part is they just made like a million spin-off games before they finally went.
Don't call them spin-offs, people. You know, people are opinion.
I'm trying to think. Okay, so since Kingdom Hearts 3, how many Kingdom Hearts things have, like, released that are, like, new to it, aside from, like, re-release compilation? It's like the Data Battles 4-3. I forgot what they.
Melody of Memory.
Oh, right, Melody of Memory. And I think that's it.
Because
I'm drawing a blank. Sorry.
Because they did, you know, Missing Link was a thing, and then it wasn't a thing. Dark Road was going to be a bigger thing, but then it ended up getting pared back. I wasn't really following it that closely to know where that ended up. But yeah, it wasn't not nearly the same glut as it was between 2 and 3. The other kind of thing that I put here is kind of an interesting shadow drop is, and Adam, maybe this is a bit of a surprise, but I think you've played this one. Electronic Arts and... what's the studio? Damn it. Aspyr have announced that Lord of the Rings War in the North has a remaster called Legacy Edition now available on consoles and PC. So you played this game back when it originally released, 2011 or so. Like, we were right out of college, not to age ourselves.
But yeah, I played it. I think it's one of those games that's honestly not great, but it had like, it's like a local co-op action RPG set in Lord of the Rings. So it's kind of like a fun, you know, weekend game. Not a great game. I remember
it's a good rental game.
Yeah, it was back then. And I remember it had some weird, like, it was co-op, but it was weird in how the co-op worked in terms of like the progression. Like, I don't remember. Maybe hopefully that's better than the remaster. But it was one of those games that I think it came out on Xbox 360, I think. And yeah, I just never got a remaster before. I wasn't expecting one now. But that's what Aspyr does. And it brings to mind like other, what are other Lord of the Rings games could get remastered? I know people
the
really
third
like
age, baby.
It feels like almost every other Lord of the Rings game feels more like beloved. Not every other, but like I know people love the Battle for Middle Earth, like RTS games. Yeah. People love the movie game for the Two Towers and the Return of the King, but just the movie game, like based on the movie, like it's kind of like a side scroller, just like action game. Not only side scroller,
Third Age,
which is basically Final Fantasy X clone.
I do love how they like it's not the most important thing at all, but like War in the North is basically like, we did such a good job in this non-canon story that no one will ever talk about how good of a job we did because we prevented disaster.
Yeah.
The
story premise of those games is so funny because it's like, yeah, War in the North is like, we have to prevent this other bad guy who's up north from interfering with the Fellowship. He's really evil and really dark. He's almost as bad as Sauron. We have to go up there and beat him, but we have to be secret about it, and no one will ever talk about this. And then, like, Third Age, like, you're not supposed to take these too seriously, but Third Age is like, we're going to follow behind the Fellowship and clean up everything, all their messes or something like that.
So it's almost like a Valkyria Chronicles 3 situation where it still takes place within, like, the first Valkyria Chronicles game, but since, like, you know, it was never acknowledged, it's like you're playing this shadow mercenary group.
Well, I mean, Valkyria Chronicles 4 is the same, too. That's what you meant.
Exactly.
It's just like, we're over on this other part of the world.
Yeah.
This is very important.
So
we're never mentioned.
Same energy. This new Legacy Edition that released for War in the North does cover, like, online support. So, you know, it's not just confined to local co-op. I was kind of skimming some reviews, and there are some useful tweaks. For example, like they don't have the one shared inventory anymore. Like each character has their own inventory, apparently now, and being able to swap between the characters for upgrading stuff like that. So there are nice quality of life tweaks to it that it's welcome. It's not just a straight one-to-one re-release. Good on them, you know, and I wonder, I do have to, you know, I didn't get to try this out myself, but always be on the lookout for Aspyr re-releases, because I do know that Aspyr has a track record of, like, introducing new bugs to their re-releases that weren't in the original version.
Yep.
So just, you know, keep an eye out on that.
In other news, we have a few trailers that released. So obviously talking about trailers on the podcast has always been interesting, but for upcoming September and beyond releases, the one that's probably most impending is Blood of Dawnwalker. This is obviously the RPG debut from Rebel Wolves, ex-Witcher developers, releasing early in September. It's the big of many big September releases. The first of many big September releases coming out on the 3rd. It's had a handful of trailers. I think it's kind of a known thing at this point, but there's Everything You Know. Basically talks primarily about story premise and then the second half about gameplay. I've watched a lot of these trailers. They're tending to blend together. But I think this the thing that this trailer primarily lays out that the other trailers haven't gone into detail of is that it talks about the antagonist who's... I watched this trailer and I forget what the antagonist's name is, like Bressis or Bremis or something like this. Sounds silly, but like none of them have common names. Let's see.
I feel like this is the if you're looking for like info on Dawnwalker and you don't want to do like a deep dive on like what Dawnwalker is, I think this should be like the one and done trailer.
Yeah,
to watch because you'll know right away after watching it whether it's a game you're interested in. It's a good overview.
Yeah, the Reader's Digest is basically there's four antagonists, Brensis and his three like lieutenants that control like different areas of the map is what it implies, and each one of them has like a different focus. The game is both though non-linear, so you can kind of go anywhere. Talks a little bit about the difference in gameplay between like daytime, where you're just kind of a human with some magical powers like hexes, and then nighttime where you're basically a vampire. It does talk about how from the premise of the game, as they talked about this previously, is that you have 30 days to save your family. And time is kind of like a resource where certain events will cost time. So you won't be able, they heavily imply that you won't be able to like do everything. I'm sure people over time will figure out the most optimal path or whatever. But the idea is that, you know, you will have to spend your time wisely and not literal time, but like, oh, completing this quest will take a day. Learning this skill will take a half an evening or whatever. And I have 30 days and I have to figure out where my family is and save them. But then the trailer says that even if you don't save them, the game will continue. Like, that's just a different outcome. So they're really selling it in terms of like, you know, what's the term? Respect the player in terms of like, if you decide not to save your family, say yes to the player. That's the term. If you decide not to save your family, that's fine. You can continue on the story regardless. So it'll be interesting to see like how much of that is what they're planning to do versus like the execution of that and how much variability there really is. But it seems kind of exciting, but also a little stressful. You know, whenever there's any sort of time mechanic, even though it's not literally like hours mechanic here. Because I obviously want to try to see everything, but it seems like no, you kind of can't. So you'll have to make some choices. Like, oh darn! But it could end up being really cool if they end up nailing it. So we'll see in not too long. A couple other trailers that are a little bit more. This next one, anyways, is for another upcoming game. This is Persona 4 Revival, releasing early next year. I think this one's a lot of retread, a lot of mechanics that they have already introduced. As being coming to the remake of Persona 4, things like Baton Pass and the knockback, and what's the other one? Grand Finale. I might not be using the correct terms, but all the different things they're adding to the combat. And I haven't played like Reload to know like which of those are borrowed from Reload, but it seems like a lot of new tool sets available to the player in combat. And they also talk about like voiced social links and things like that. Pretty long trailer for. Not really a trailer. The Stranger Than Heaven from Sega and RGG Studio, also releasing early next year, in January, actually, on this one. This is primarily two hosts talking through the combat options and playing a little snippet of the game. So it's basically 20 or so minutes of them going through the combat, doing a little combat section, talking about the directional guarding, the counterattacks, the way it works. It goes quite in depth, and I did watch it to try to say like, okay, what can I actually put into the podcast here to talk about it. From what I could take away, like the different blocks and attacks are like mapped to your character's left and right hands. So like if you press both triggers, you do a grab. If you want to block directionally, you have to block with a specific arm. And talking about, you know, how the enemy responds to attacks depends on how much stamina they have. Like if they have a little, they'll be knocked down. If they have a lot, they'll still be knocked back.
It's just commentary from the entire build that they showed at Summer Game Fest. That's okay. Pretty much it. Yeah, so it's the entire Summer Game Fest build plus commentary over it. And if people want to know like the exact specifics of how combat works, like I wrote up a preview piece, what they commentated over.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
But yeah, good for a refresher. Mm-hmm. And it does seem pretty intricate and involved and kind of weighty. It's like slow and weighty, not as flashy as like mm-hmm. something grounded. Like the other, yeah. And then we have a trailer for Phantom Blade Zero. This is the Souls-like coming out.
Not a Souls-like.
Not a Souls-like.
I know a lot. It's funny because like the developers even like address it. It's like they don't really call it a Souls-like. They don't really put a label on it. They want people players to like try it out for themselves and see like, you know, whether it's a Souls-like to them or not, but they They've intentionally tried to like be try to shut off the
avoid that term.
The categorization of being a soldier.
And this trailer has a little bit of everything. It feels like a very extended like hype movie trailer. A lot of like cinematic scenes, a lot of combat. At the end, it goes into like rock music and, you know, gameplay like montage. There's like a giant ass spinning buzzsaw like that the character ends up like hijacking and using. It feels like a really high octane kind of amp you up sort of trailer. Well, it gets there at the end. It starts out a little slower, but it's a pretty long trailer and it kind of gets there. But they call this the pre-order trailer, and it's basically like, you know, hell yeah, look at all the neat stuff we've crammed into this game, both on a story front and on a gameplay front. So I think it looks pretty neat. Even if it's a little over the top with some of the like butt rock at the end, but I'm okay with it.
Yeah, the new big reveal out of this new Phantom Blade Zero trailer was, hey, they announced that Donnie Yen has been working on it, had a pretty involved role in it as like a mocap, worked on a lot of mocap for this game, and the battle scenes for it, and they'll have like a more involved like separate direct event. August 17, like a state of play, which people have
a couple days away, basically.
Yeah, there might be a demo coming out for it out of that state of play, so people might be able to try this out for themselves soon. This will be out, I think, I forgot the exact release date. It's October 29, I believe. So, you know, they're really just amping up the marketing for Phantom Blade Zero and trying to get people. Hopefully, like that demo stuff was real, because I know it's like data mine, but not exactly sure if it was real or not. But it's a good idea to let people try it out for themselves, because I know there's a lot of questions. But is this game for? So yes, Donnie Yen is a creative consultant, facial motion capture actor for one of the bosses. I'm very excited for this. This looks outstanding. Very, very.
Mm.
See how this.
A couple small Pokemon updates. Well, I guess small or big, depending on where you're coming from. Pokemon Bank, which has been in service for a long time, will be shutting down on February 25th of next year. And I'm not a huge Pokemon follower of this, but I guess the Pokemon Bank is essential for like being able to forward port your Mons from like the Game Boy Advance era, like all the way to current day. And like the way that strings together is like you put them in the bank and then you pull them out in black and white, and then you use like the PAL park. And I'm probably getting the terms wrong because I haven't followed it, but there was a path to transfer those Gen 3 game Pokemon to current day through Pokemon Bank and the Pokemon Home and each individual game, things like that. Pokemon Bank will be shutting down. But alongside of that, the Switch versions of Pokemon Fire Red and Leaf Green will get Pokemon Home support. I don't think that patches all the holes, but basically there will be fewer opportunities for those that have like followed the series for a long time and have like legacy mons that they want to, you know, you have a kind of a line in the sand now for if you want to port them forward to like a Switch title or something like that, or get them into Home. Pokemon Bank will be shutting down in February.
I'm not really into Pokemon anymore, but didn't they have to like pay like a subscription to use that service or something like that?
That rings a bell, but I actually don't know offhand. I think it did have some sort of nominal monthly fee, but I admittedly get Bank and Home mixed up. Like Bank was kind of like the predecessor to Home, and Home's kind of, it seems like based on this, that's where they're kind of centralizing their efforts as the service to have accompanying your Pokemon games. I'm looking up here. Okay. Yeah. Pokemon Home is free to use, but does have like some premium plans that you can opt into. To finish out, we just have a handful of dates to go through. Let's see here. This one's kind of interesting. The Legend of Heroes 3, White Witch Renewal, is coming to Switch through the Egg console. And then Kite did a really good job, and Adam can speak to this as well, about how Legend of Heroes 3 now will be, you know, playable in its original Japanese format through that Egg console. But it was localized a while back on the PSP, but in a manner where they renumbered everything and the translation wasn't great. You talked about that trilogy on the PSP, right?
Yep.
So, And Kite does a good job saying that, you know, this one, 3, was previously localized as 2. Wow. I'm like making a diagram with my hands. While 5 became 3 and 4 became 1. Like I almost did like a flow chart. But anyways, Legend of Heroes 3, like actually number 3 as they released, will be available on Switch through Ed Console. But just the original Japanese version.
So if you want to understand the Trails series, even before Trails of the Sky, you have to play these first, or else nothing will make sense. That's how it goes.
But this game is very influential. If you were back in the day, apparently this game kind of inspired a Korean developer to make Arcturus, which is, and then that got localized by Falcom, and that inspired to make Trails. You know, so it's just like everyone's just
the circle of life.
Village in the Shade, which I believe is a game you talked about last week on the podcast.
Yes.
Released in Japan at the end of July. It has a Western release date now. It'll be launching on PC, Switch, and PS5 on October 27th, being published by NIS America. And they've also given their announced trailers and all that.
This initially wasn't on my forecast, but after what James and others have talked about this game, it's like, man, this game sounds cool. This game sounds really cool. Maybe it's going to be, I'll try it out.
Angeline Era, which was kind of like I heard it described as kind of like a indie East-like, which released on PC late last year, is going to be releasing on consoles, Xbox, PlayStation, and Switch on September 2nd. Anemo, I got my consonants mixed up, is going to get its release on PC, PlayStation 5, Xbox, and mobile devices on September 16th. Nothing releasing in mid-September. So you have one day to play Anemo before second chapter and Fire Emblem. Yeah. But this is a free-to-play title with, obviously, monetization outside of that. And then I accidentally closed my... my outline. The last one here is Steins Gate Reboot. Oh, we talked about this. The Xbox version is going to launch on October 29th instead of the original August 20th. I should have talked about this when we talked about Steins Gate. All right. The Switch PS5 versions are coming out on October. The Xbox one was going to be in August with the PC version, but now Xbox is going to be with the other consoles in October. So August will just be PC, consoles October. I think I got that right.
Yeah, I think that's for the Western release.
For the Western release, correct.
I don't know if it's launching on like Xbox in Japan, admittedly, but like if you're getting like the Japanese version on console, that's still within the August.
And that's all the headlines that I had. So next week we might get James on again to talk about Steins Gate Reboot with a little bit more detail. I don't think we can talk about games like Brigadine Abyss or Zero Company quite yet, but maybe I'll double check those embargo dates. And then of course the week after we're going into September, and every week will be a new game. So it'll be busy from that point, basically through the next 2 months. But again, want to shout out the written preview for Fire Emblem up on the site from Adam and Cullen. You got the Steins Gate Reboot review from James. Zero Company preview from Scott. And for those interested, the technical kind of look-in for Elder Scrolls Oblivion Remastered on Switch 2. You can find RPG Site on all the social media networks. Just search for RPG Space Site, and you should be able to find us. Join our Discord, discord.gg/RPGSite. If you listen to this podcast on your podcast service of choice, leave us a like, leave us a rating, leave us a comment. We'd like to see those. And we'll be back next week with another episode of the TetraCast. So until you hear from us next time, stay safe, take care. We'll talk to you all later.